You're listening to episode 4 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Well, it must be time for the annual Slackware extravaganza, because Slackware 14, as you know, has been released quite some time ago now, but I just got my DVD in the mail this past weekend, so I updated my systems to Slackware 14. That's what we're going to talk about in this episode. We'll also talk about a new interface for the slackbuilds.org website. And we'll talk about some other stuff too, like a very cool multimedia-related video that a listener sent in, and a couple of other things. So let's get started. I'm sure you've heard by now, either on this show or elsewhere, that Slackware 14 has been released. It was released September 28th of 2012, so it's been almost a month. But the Slackware DVD, to which I subscribe, got delivered to me by post about 5 days ago, I think, now. So I spent the weekend updating my desktop and my laptop Slackware systems, and I have to say that everything went really, really well, beautifully well in the case of my laptop. I upgraded my laptop. I copied my home directory over to an external drive, did a complete reinstall, and I even changed the file system from EXT4 to JFS, because I wanted to try JFS on a solid-state drive. I don't know if I've mentioned this story on the show, or if I've just been talking about this in IRC, but some guy came over to me and wanted to get rid of his SSD card, or his SSD drive, rather, and it was a 500 gigabyte drive, and he didn't want to get rid of it, he just wanted more space. And so I told him, well, I've got this laptop hard drive that's a terabyte. If you want that, I'll trade you for the 500 SSD, and to my amazement, he did. So I got an SSD drive, 500 gigabyte SSD drive, in my laptop. Now, since having done that, I feel like the battery's been even worse, and the battery was getting bad as it was. This is my Lenovo laptop. Battery was getting pretty bad anyway. I feel like it got worse after I got the SSD, which was completely unexpected. I thought the opposite would be the case. So I've not had a great experience lately with the battery on this particular laptop. And I'm pretty sure it's just this laptop's battery, because I've been running Slackware Current on another brand of laptop with a completely new, fresh battery, and it lasts like 6 hours or something. I mean, it's all day. You know, I work and I work and I work. So yeah, unfortunately, I think this laptop and the screen starts to flicker if I move it around too much. I think the laptop might actually be going away at some point in the future. Hopefully not too soon, because I really, really like it. Although I have another gripe about it that I could mention, but I won't right now. Point being, SSD drive, bad battery. I read somewhere online, JFS will make all your battery problems go away if you use it with SSD. So I'm trying it on SSD right now, JFS. Why not? So anyway, did a reinstall of Slackware 14 and then copied my home directory over. Did a user add for my users and reassigned their home directories, or rather assigned their home directories to the directories to which I copied all their data, and everything's back up and running like magic. It worked brilliantly. Nothing at all went wrong. It was almost surreal, because I started it back up and everything was perfect, exactly as I'd left it. It was just one of those moments where I was just like, man, this is the way it's supposed to work. This is exactly how it's supposed to work. Because I can say that I have just done proprietary operating system upgrades in my day job, and they have gone horribly. I mean, patently bad upgrade process. Even the system that is based on Unix that I upgraded, the upgrade process was just dismal. Things broke, the user data was not transported over correctly. I've tried it many different ways. It just doesn't seem to work. The migration path just was not there. So that was not good. And on Slackware, on my laptop, and I keep saying, because I'm going to tell you about the desktop experience in a moment. So the laptop worked splendidly. Nothing was the matter at all. It was great. A couple of minor differences in Slackware 14. There's a network manager now, or there's the option to use network manager now. I am using that on my laptop. Before, I used Wicked and was very, very happy with it, but using network manager now, and so far I've been pleased with it, although I have to say it's only been a couple of days. I haven't really given it a whole lot of testing, but I've used it on other systems and it tends to work fine, so I'm probably going to be okay with it. Something related to that is that I found an Atheros Wi-Fi card in my box of parts and decided to swap it out into my Lenovo, which has a bad screen and a bad battery, and I'm starting to hate more, I guess, every day now, especially because of this. But I took this Atheros card, I took out the Broadcom that had shipped with the Lenovo, for which I have to do firmware cutter and all that other stuff, put the Atheros card in, started it back up, and the thing wouldn't even start. And it gave me a message saying that an unauthorized, that's their term, unauthorized wireless card, or network card, has been detected. Please remove the card from the PCI port and restart. I couldn't believe what I was reading. I mean, it was surreal to me. I'd never seen a computer tell me that before, of any brand, much less a generic PC. I mean, you're supposed to be able to swap out parts on those things, right? Well, apparently not on this. So I was really, really upset at this laptop, at Lenovo. I went into BIOS and tried to see if there was anything in there. I disabled some kind of health check or something when you first boot. Doesn't matter. If you have something that is not approved by Lenovo in the wireless card port, it doesn't boot. It was shocking. I was amazed. It was just very, very disappointing. But that's not anything to do with Linux or Slackware 14, for that matter. Just thought I would bring that up because it was something that recently happened. Okay, Slackware 14, network manager. It's working fine so far. I'm using it on the laptop, not on the other computer. Thunderbird works brilliantly. Again, that was one of the things that just kind of sublimely worked. You know, I use Thunderbird for my mail client on my laptop, not for any reason, just because I feel like I should use Thunderbird because I'm always recommending it to people. So it's like that's the Thunderbird instance that I provide myself. And it picked up all my mail settings, my account settings, all my old email. It's, again, just as if though I had never turned... As if though nothing had ever happened. It was just as if though I'd never changed anything. So it was really, really nice. It was a great experience. Can't complain. Other things that Slackware 14 has, of course, GIMP 2.8. It's incredible to be running GIMP 2.8 on Slackware. It's the most wonderful thing to have ever happened to me. It's brilliant. I love it. I'm beside myself. Darktable, great application. You know, there's just so much right now on Linux that makes me excited and happy. I'm very excited, very, very happy. So I go to update my desktop, and it goes really, really well, except for a couple of things, and these are, I guess, cautionary tales rather than complaints, because it was no one's fault but my own. The desktop hard drive, I upgraded my hard drive and failed to remember that the hard drive was a EFI partition. It's a GUID partitioned drive. So I tried to partition it with like FDisk or something like that, and it didn't. It appeared to take, but it didn't actually take. In the past, I thought I had gotten warnings telling me, "Hey, this is a GUID partition, not a DOS partition or a DOS table, whatever. So you need to use a different program." But it didn't tell me that this time. So I thought that everything was okay. I installed Slackware onto the SSD drive in my tower, the little 16 gig SSD drive, installed Slackware onto that, setting the /var and the /temp and the /home directory to the internal normal hard drive that I just partitioned incorrectly, but I didn't know that at the time. So I thought everything was okay, everything seemed to be installing okay. Reboot, copy all my user data back over, that might have been a little bit premature, copied all my user data back over to my hard drive, and then I think I installed a bunch of applications, like the Slacker Media dependency set with SBOPKG, and kind of started using the system, and interestingly, it all kind of worked for a while, but there would be little weird bugs, like little weird things would pop up, like ConsoleKit couldn't start. I'd click OK, not really understanding what ConsoleKit was, but I was like, well, maybe I can just ignore that and it'll go away. Probably a bad idea. So I would do that and everything would work, and then it would start, you know, little things wouldn't work. Cups was giving me a nightmare of a time. It just would not work. Couldn't add printers, couldn't do different things, and I'd keep checking logs, and sure enough, there were non-existent directories that were supposed to exist in /var. That was really strange. So I tried to kind of hobble my way through it on Monday, just trying to like, well, okay, I'll create this directory, and I'll touch this file, and now it Now I'll get a step further, but I knew deep down that something had gone wrong during the install. I traced it back to what had happened was I'd partitioned this hard drive incorrectly. It was not supposed to be. It didn't partition as a true DOS table. It had partitioned as an EFI partition map or whatever, and so I had to redo that. So I repartitioned it. I think I went ahead and reinstalled just to keep my own sanity because I didn't want to have to sit there and reconstruct /var, and I had just installed the previous day, so it wasn't like I was really undoing that much work. So I did a reinstall there. I seem to recall somehow being able to keep my /home partition, although that doesn't sound right because I had to repartition that drive. I'm not really sure what exactly I did. The point being, though, that I had fooled myself into thinking that I'd correctly partitioned the hard drive, not the SSD card. That was still fine. But the hard drive that I'd grabbed off of a shelf had the wrong partition map. I'd fooled myself into thinking that I'd done it correctly. I hadn't. I had to go into, parted, and clear the partition map, reestablish a new MS-DOS table, and then create the partitions in FDisk, and finally do a reinstall of Slackware so that /var was actually writable this time. One thing that tipped me off, I remember, I was doing a search for some packages that I could have sworn it should have been installed in the default Slackware install, and sure enough, there was no var log packages, and I thought, yeah, that's probably not a good sign. Either I'm not running software right now, or it didn't record anything that it had installed. So yeah, so the /var partition, you kind of want to make sure that's readable and writable and everything by the system during the install, apparently. Didn't know that. I mean, you should know that. It kind of makes sense, but I guess I didn't realize it was not being written to, and that was kind of a deal breaker. So /var on a different partition normally works fine, but you better make sure that that partition is actually functioning. Okay, so other than that, there was one other issue with the desktop install, and that was KMail. KMail 2 has come out. As of, I think, 4.6, KDE 4.6, I think, or maybe 4.5. But it couldn't have been 4.5, because I was using 4.5. So it must have been like 4.6. And I was using 4.6 or 7 or 8 on my laptop, having updated from Alien Bob's binary packages. But I don't use KMail on my laptop, so I never noticed KMail 2. So I start the desktop and KMail 2, and I start KMail 2, which is what I use for like my work email and stuff, start that up, and it says something about wanting to start a migration thing to translate all of my data from KMail to KMail 2. Thought that was unusual, first of all, because I thought, well, would it really be so different? I mean, would the format have really changed that much between KMail and KMail 2? Has email actually changed that much between KMail and KMail 2? I mean, why do we need to migrate? I don't know. To this day, I don't know. But I'm not going to argue because I didn't even look into it. So something about KMail 2 is doing something substantially different. And I assume it's the PIM, the Personal Information Manager or whatever. So it does some kind of migration, but it fails. And apparently, because I did a couple of extensive internet searches on this, that's a common thing. KML2's migration assistant does not function properly. This is not unprecedented. I just dealt with this on a different system, a proprietary OS, with their built-in mail program not migrating correctly as well. So, I don't know. It's apparently that's something that desktops need to deal with, the ability to migrate your data in your email program. The reason this kind of upset me was because on my laptop, as I've just mentioned, Thunderbird migrated perfectly. And to its credit, that has been one of the things that I keep telling people. Thunderbird, Thunderbird, Thunderbird. It just keeps working. You migrate your system, you migrate it to a different computer, you migrate it to a different operating system. Thunderbird just keeps looking at email. You know, it doesn't care. And I really strongly, firmly admire that. As I've often said on this program before, I think email, in terms of setting it up and everything, is over complex. I think it confuses people. I think there are a lot of variables involved. It's one of those things you don't really want to do more than once in your lifetime, much less every time you update your system. So the fact that other desktop environments are shipping with email clients that require migration, and then the migration doesn't work, I think that's a bad thing, sort of. So I was really happy that Thunderbird just magically worked, and a little bit frustrated that KMail 2 didn't just work, but it turned out to be a fairly easy fix, I guess, sort of. I mean, for me, I think it would have been really just a deal breaker for a normal user, because you have to go in and delete a bunch of config files from the hidden directory of .kde/share/config, and then you have to rerun the migration assistant basically manually, and then it works. But if you don't do that, then from what I can tell from everything I've been reading online, including the Fedora KDE mailing list, KMail 2's migration is not working, and that's a real shame. From KMail to KMail 2, that shouldn't be something that's failing. You know, that should be something that just you shouldn't even have to think about. I mean, okay, from Thunderbird to KML2, from some other application to KML2, you could almost understand why there would be some hiccups. But from KML to KML2, that seems like something that should just, it shouldn't require thought on the user's part, much less debugging, reverse engineering, and fixing. And it's been a while, too. I mean, this is 4.8 I'm on. KDE 4.8, I think, and it's been on KML2 since 4.5 or 6 or 7 or something, so I don't know. I was really, really surprised and disappointed by that. This, of course, led me on a kind of a tirade against Akonadai, Nepomuk, and Strigi, because that unholy trinity of kind of like, we will manage your semantic desktop thing has been nothing but pain from the very beginning, and this sort of spontaneous crusade that lasted for about half an hour, led me onto some really, really informative and interesting websites. And one of them was an Aaron Saigo blog post. And anytime you're ever angry at anything in open source, you should just go to Aaron Saigo's blog, because the guy's amazing. I mean, he explains things so clearly, so pragmatically, so well that you can't read it and stay mad. You're just like, oh, okay, I get it. That makes sense. Now, why didn't they just say so? I read a post on sort of the importance of Nepomuk on his blog, and then I got onto someone else's blog about how sort of Strigi and Nepomuk kind of work together and what Akonadai really does. All this interesting stuff, really, really fascinating, really kind of enlightened me in terms of what they were going for and why it was all kind of important and it really should be running and how it's getting better and all this other stuff. So I really kind of, I got a better understanding of how all that stuff works, not well enough to actually explain it to you. And as to whether I'm actually going to use any of those features that they're talking about, I'm not even sure about that. But it was good to at least see where the programmers were coming from and kind of understanding some of the obstacles that they were facing. And you really do have an appreciation for it if you read up on it a little bit. So I don't know what happened with the KML2 migration. It was frustrating, not to the point of me saying, okay, forget KML2, I'm just going to use Thunderbird from now on. Admittedly, the thought crossed my mind, but in the end, it was a fairly simple fix. Just had to remove some old config files, which I can kind of live with that. I can actually understand that. I don't know which way is better. There seem to be two methods of dealing with this. There's the proprietary OS that I've dealt with. Their way is, if a config file doesn't quite agree with their new way of doing things, just throw it out. Don't keep a copy. Don't alert the user. Just throw it out. Now, Slackware's way of doing this is actually warning the user, hey, there's a config file in this program that you're asking me to install right now. Should I overwrite or keep or archive your old config file or whatever? And you can choose. KDE's method seems to be more like, well, we'll keep the old config file, but the application just isn't going to work like you think it should work. So I don't know which, I mean, obviously the Slackware way is better, but it's all in the console, so you can actually, it can stop and it can say, hi, this is your computer, this is what we've encountered, what would you like to do? That would be nice. I think that would be kind of probably the best case scenario. None of the desktop environments that I've ever dealt with actually do that, so I'm assuming there's some kind of reason that they don't do that. And I do understand how tricky it must be for all those config files and all the changes in applications to deal with, oh, this is an old config file, we would ideally like to keep most of the user's preferences, but we need to change this, this, and this. I don't know. Maybe there's a way to do that. Maybe someone could develop it. Maybe I could. Who knows? For now, I guess when something breaks, like KML to KML2, you simply go in as the user, get rid of, you know, the old config files, the little thing that says, yes, I've run the migration assistant, you know, just ditch that. It's like the first run file, and then rerun the migration assistant, and you're back up and running. So it's manageable. It's just not perfect. But again, that's not unprecedented. I've seen this exact same problem, or this exact same end user experience on other operating systems on a daily basis. So can't really say that it's the worst thing in the world. Now, I've done tutorials on this show before, literally a step-by-step install of Slackware and setting things up and how to do all the package management stuff, so I'm not going to do anything like that this time, but I do kind of want to highlight a new website that Slackware is kind of sponsoring and acknowledging called docs.slackware.com. So if you've been sitting around thinking, wow, I wish the Slack book would finally finish, you know, version 3, I think that it may be going more toward a wiki setup. Certainly that's what docs.slackware.com is. It's a wiki that I intend to start editing myself as soon as I get the time on everything that you'd need to know about Slackware. And hopefully they'll keep a structure to it and kind of make it logical and a lot better than most other wikis I've ever seen. But yeah, hopefully it'll be a really good resource. So check out docs.slackware.com. And if you're an old Slackware pro and feel like writing a tutorial or something like that, or an explanatory body of text about some subtlety of Slackware, then feel free to contribute. I'm sure they would love to have you. As for my own little documentation project, which I, of course, call Slacker Media, that's at a really good place right now, actually. It's at a very nicely version-independent place where you can approach it from 13.37 or 14.0 or whatever and still get the same relevant information from that work. So I'm not going to be updating it a whole lot. I've already made a couple of little minor updates to the Q file because LV2 core, for instance, is now LV2. You know, some packages have changed, some packages have been introduced that I think are worthy of inclusion. So I'll be making a little bit of an update here and there, but for the most part, the work itself, I think, is at a place where it's safe to approach. You'll be able to get the same information regardless of what version of Slackware you're on, which is a good thing. That was exactly what the most recent revision was aiming to do, and I'm pleased now to have seen that it's still very, very true. So the workflow for me was to install Slackware, migrate my user data back over, or if you've got it partitioned in such a way that you could just install without clearing your user data, you could do it that way too. But you do that, and then you download the Slacker Media Q file for SBOPKG, then you install SBOPKG, run the Q file, and that gets you a whole bunch of libraries and dependencies, and then you go through and manually install all the big applications that you know that you will be using, like Kdenlive, Qtractor, FFmpeg, and so on. So Audacity, that would be a good one. So that's kind of the workflow that I have for my Slackware setup. And what can I say? I mean, it worked perfectly for 14.0. So really great little system. I mean, the review of Slackware 14 really would have been, it's exactly like 13.37. Because it is. I mean, it's Slackware. It's the best. So if you've not tried Slackware 14, or Slackware, give it a shot. You'll be surprised, I think, at how nice of a system it is, how organized it is, how stable it is, how logical it is, and how when things go wrong, you exactly know where to look and how to figure it out and how to fix it. Beautiful, beautiful system. Try it out if you have not tried it at all. And after the coffee break, we're going to talk about a brand new interface to the slackbuilds.org system of installing applications. You'll like it. Well, I do anyway. As they say, nothing goes better with Slackware than coffee, so go get yourself some coffee, and while you're at it, pick up a copy of Slackware and see how they go together in real life. I think you'll like it. Quite some time ago now, it was right around the time when 14 was looming over our heads, so it was about a month, maybe a month and a half ago, a thread on the slackbuilds.org users mailing list started up. And someone in there was saying how it would be nice if the admins would enforce a line in the slackbuild.info file that comes along with the build script. So in case you don't know how Slack builds work, I'm sorry, I shouldn't presume. So you've got a Slack build script, right? And all it does is compile the source code for you. That's what its job is. It compiles the source code into a destination directory that it then tars and zips up into basically a mirror of your computer's hard drive, except without anything except that software that it's going to install. And then when you install a software package on Slackware with Slack with install PKG, it untars that path to your root directory, and it therefore parses and distributes, I should say, all of those files into the directories that they belong on your system. It works out really, 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 really well. It does a couple of other things too, like takes a record, keeps a record of what it's put and where it has put it and all that other good stuff. But that's essentially what it does. So along with this build script that you download when you go to slackbuilds.org, you get a README file, a .info file, and possibly some other files, like if there needs to be a patch applied to the source code, which is actually a lot, pretty rare actually, because most everything just comes as is. But that's the idea. So you get a build script, a .info file, and a README. The build script you tend to not really need to do anything with, usually. I mean, unless there's a customization that you want to make, which you're free to do. But the more often your workflow is the README and the .info file. And traditionally, the README has contained a little snippet of information about the application that you're considering installing, as well as any kind of, oh, by the way, before you install this, you're going to need to install this package and that package and this package. And by the way, you also might want to pass this flag to Slack build, to the Slack build script so that you enable this feature, whatever. So it's information. And then the .info has been a lot more kind of just straight technical, kind of like, this is the download link. This is the MD5 sum of the downloaded package, or the source code tarball that you'll be downloading. This is who maintains this Slack build. Here's where to contact them. It's been kind of very straightforward. And it's worked for a very long time. So on the mailing list, someone was saying how nice it would be if in the info file, where it is very rigorously kept, like here's the name, here's the location, here's the MD5 sum, in that info file, couldn't they have a dependency list? Well, of course, everyone knew exactly what this person had in mind, right? The problem in the README is that you can't easily parse and find the dependencies, because the author of the README might list it on a line-by-line basis, or might list it with commas or spaces as delimiters. You never know. Whereas in the info file, you've got all capitalized dependencies equals, or like requires equals, quote, and then a space delimited list of the package names, end quote. So that would be very easy to parse. Why would you want to parse a list of dependencies? Duh. Because you're writing a script for yourself to go in and automatically resolve those dependencies. At least that's what everyone would assume, right? Whether or not that's correct or not, I don't know. And frankly, whether or not that's what the person is doing, I really don't care. That's none of my business. That's why this is called free software. You can do that sort of thing. If you're a Slackware user and you want to be able to write a script for yourself that will go in and automatically resolve all the dependencies and basically turn Slack builds into your own sort of lo-fi aptitude or yum, then you're obviously able to do that, and you should be able to do that. And for that reason, when this issue got brought up on the mailing list, I said, as a Slack build maintainer, as one of the, you know, a maintainer for a couple of the scripts, I said I'd be happy to follow a format defined by this person to make that possible. Like, if they want me to list the required dependencies on some special line in the README file, I would do that. No one really responded to my offer, if I recall correctly, but the conversation continued by the hundreds, you know, I mean, like, just, it just kept going and going, and people eventually, you know, I mean, eventually there was kind of, it was a very polite conversation, but towards the end, people were like, well, let's just fork it, let's just, we'll just mirror SBOPKG, or I mean, not SBOPKG, slackbuilds.org SBO, and we'll add our own line in and all this other stuff. So finally, some of the admins kind of stepped in and said, well, look, don't do anything yet. Let's just wait till 14 comes out and we'll see what we can, we'll see what we come up with. And so somehow it kind of fell into this idea of in the .info file, there would be a requires line, and that requires line would give you a list of the dependencies, the required dependencies. Optional dependencies would still be listed in the README, and any kind of build note, like, hey, you need to have this enabled, or you might want to enable this if you need this kind of support, would be in the README file. On the mailing list, this sounded fine. In practice, I found, while I was reinstalling, or while I was installing Slackware 14, this was completely inconvenient to me, and it really took me by surprise. I didn't expect it to be inconvenient for me. But if you think about, you know, your old workflow of, okay, you search for a package that you want to install, like Audacity, and you look at the README. You take note of what is required. Let's say it's SoundTouch and TuLame and WXPython, and then you go and install those, and then you come back to Audacity, and you install Audacity. That was kind of my workflow before. Now it seems to be more like, go to Audacity, find out what the, go, read the README to see if there are any optional dependencies and any build notes that you need to take note of. Then go over to the info file and take note of any required dependencies. Then go to the required dependencies and install them, reading the README and the info file, and then go back to Audacity, recheck the info file, check the README file again. Oh, there's an optional dependency I forgot about. Go get the optional dependency, read the README and the info file of that, come back to Audacity, open the README file, got everything taken care of, build and install. And believe it or not, that extra file that kept kind of like, oh yeah, I need to check the info file first. Oh yeah, I need to check the README now just in case there was an optional dependency that I do care about that wasn't listed in the info file. It started driving me crazy. It started driving absolutely crazy. Like, it was ruining the process for me. It was really, really disturbing the way that I was using Slack builds. Now, for some people, it wouldn't have mattered, because a lot of people go to the slackbuilds.org website, and they look at the web page, and they all the information is there, and so it kind of works out. And so I tried a couple of different ways. I would try to go to slackbuilds.org in a text browser, and it's very text browser friendly, so that was kind of working, but it just I wasn't used to it, you know? And so then I would try to go into SBOPKG, which is, of course, Chess Griffin's, now Slack Magic's, but formerly Chess Griffin's kind of interface to slackbuilds.org, where you can work in a in-curses interface if you want, but all the information isn't on one screen there either. So then I was like, well, let me just try using it just as a line command. So that was working a little bit better. You would cd into /var/lib/slack SBOPKG/14.0, look at your available packages, cd into the one that you want to build, and you'd kind of take a look at all the files, and then you could just do SBOPKG-I and then the name of the file that you want to install, and that was working. And at that point, it felt so much like I was doing kind of a BSD port kind of thing that I started wondering if it wouldn't be worth really hand-rolling, custom-rolling, whatever the term is, my own BSD port system. It even occurred to me at one point that I should try to port BSD port over to Slackware, but I felt like, number one, that might be over my head, and then number two, BSD port actually does dependency resolution, which I do not want. So I thought, well, how hard would this be to just make a little bash script? So the first thing that I did was I made a bash script that if I was in my port tree, as it were, I could do a cat of both the packages readme and the .info file. And that would show me, obviously, in one screenful, the readme, which would have my build options and my recommended or my optional dependencies, and then the info file, which has my required dependencies. And that was working pretty well. And after I'd gotten that down, I thought, you know what, all I have to do is like one more thing in this file, and I could have it parse the link to download this application and execute the Slack build, and even optionally run install PKG for me. I've just reinvented BSD ports for Slackware. So I threw a little script together. I call it Sport, which stands for Slackware Port. Sport. And it's got a couple of different options, and it uses the case conditional statement to parse which one you want to do. So I've mentioned before how I was kind of really growing fond of these sort of the command and then the verb and then the noun kind of setup. That's what I've got for sport. So I'm thinking of, for instance, LVM create the set or git clone this URL. So for sport, I've been doing sport search, for instance, W3M. What that does is it looks in the designated directory of your port tree, which you can set in the script. Right now I'm just using the default location of the SBO PKG port tree, as it were. I keep calling it a port tree, but obviously it's just an rsync of slackbuilds.org. So it looks there, and it looks exactly as they recommend for BSD ports. It just does an ls on this directory in any category, so an asterisk, slash, asterisk, the search term asterisk, and it returns any matches that it can find. It's not case insensitive yet. I'll probably introduce that feature sooner or later, but for now it's doing that, and so it would tell you exactly where W3M is. And in this case, that would be in the port tree, in the category of network, in W3M. And you'd get two matches, actually, Emacs-W3M, which is the W3M.L for Emacs, or W3M itself. So with those two matches, you can then do a sport cat W3M. Now that will cat the readme and the info file for W3M. I need to work on that a little bit. I think at that point, after the search, I think you need to be a little bit more specific and say, like, sport cat network slash W3M. But right now, I'm kind of getting by without having to do that. Point being, you have a cat command where you can cat both the readme and the info onto one screen, which is what I really wanted. That was the thing that I was trying to solve. And then as icing on that cake, you've got a sport build W3M. Actually, I'm sorry, sport build network slash W3M. You do need to be specific about which one you want to build. And so you can do a sport build W3M, network slash W3M, and it changes directory into W3M. It wgets the package if it's not already there, and it builds it and dumps the Slack package over in slash temp, which is where the default location for that sort of thing is anyway. You can also do a sport install network slash W3M, for instance, and that does the same thing, except it also runs the install PKG command at the end of it. So that's typically what I do. But during testing, it was getting annoying to constantly reinstall every package in slash TMP, so I made a build as well. And that's it. That's the command. It's really quite simple. It's not a very complex bash script, for better or for worse. There are probably going to be improvements eventually, but for now, if you have any experience with BSD ports and you kind of want that same workflow of actually changing directory into your port tree and looking at the listings there and executing essentially make commands to deal with those those packages in your port tree, this is it. This is exactly the same flow as BSD ports. Now, what it doesn't do is any kind of queue file. So it's not like SBOPKG, where you could say, you know, it's not a replacement for SBOPKG, for instance. If you like SBOPKG, and I do, then you would want to have that on your system as well. But Sport will at least enable you to get in there and look around, poke around, and especially in those applications, at least for me, Miro, for instance, M-I-R-O, the pod video catcher, pod catcher thing, and media player, that's got an atrocious number of dependencies because it wants WebKit GTK, GTKMM, PangoMM, CairoMM, I think something else. Oh yeah, it's got a lot of stuff, believe me. Some GStreamer stuff. You know, just a bunch of stuff that I'm sure comes by default on a GNOME box, but just is nowhere to be found on a default Slackware install. So for that, especially, Sport was just brilliant. Because I could go into the directory tree, the port tree, and do my sport search Miro, and then sport cat Miro, whatever category it was in, I forget. And it told me exactly the dependencies that I needed, and right there with it on my screen, I could cat those other dependencies and install their dependencies and work my way, you know, back up toward Miro with really efficient commands without having to go and write things down or flip back and forth between screens. It was very, very simple, very efficient. I really enjoyed it, and it felt like a BSD port system. It didn't feel like, I mean, even SBOPKG, which got me halfway there, it didn't really feel like the same workflow of what at least I had for BSD ports. This is really very, very similar to what I did with BSD ports. So you can find Sport at slackermedia.info/sport. You can also find it on Gatorius at gatorius.org/slackport. So check that out. Look at the code if you know Bash scripting. I'm sure you have better ways of doing certain things than I have done. And, you know, if you use Slackware, test it out if you want. I mean, it's pretty simple, but I find it very efficient and really quite the pleasure to use if you at all ever got used to BSD ports, which, I mean, I only used BSD full time for, well, I mean, do you ever use anything full time? But when I was working on the first edition of Slacker Media, I think it was, I was using it nearly full time. It was the laptop that I took out with me was a BSD laptop, and I really got used to the BSD port system. I mean, really took a liking to it. So this is really, really refreshing. So please do test it out, take a look at it, let me know what you think, send me patches if you want, or suggestions or feature requests, and that's it. Oh, so prerequisites for Sport, I guess, would sort of be SBOPKG, or simply rsync the Slack builds site, as it were, to your local hard drive, because you will want a listing of all the available Slack builds. There's nothing built in for it right now for case insensitivity, for queue files, for the difference between if there's a package for some reason that requires you to download something differently if you're on 64-bit versus 32-bit, there's no allowance for that yet. And there's no allowance for like a make, like in BSD ports, there was like a make install clean thing that you could do. You know, it would make it, it would install it, and then it would clean up after itself. There's nothing like that in Sport. So Sport will leave, you know, downloaded stuff in your port tree, and I haven't done anything with that yet. So there's a couple of features in the pipeline that need to happen to make it a more serious tool, but for now it's kind of nice. So give it a shot. Let me know what you think. You know, I should probably mention as an addendum to my Sport story that I was literally, I spent like all day yesterday typing out an email, trying to type out an email to the mailing list, sort of expressing my concern that the information was now in two files and how that had kind of disrupted my workflow. And obviously I didn't want to flame the mailing list. I'm not quite bold enough to try to flame a Slackware-related mailing list yet. But I did want to express it because I was wondering if it had upset anyone else's workflow either. And the email, you know, I just kept looking at it and I just kept thinking, all I'm doing here is whining about something that doesn't work for me. And while that's fair, and I think that I might still ask the mailing list if anyone else is feeling this way. But at the end of the email, it kept occurring to me that I could just fix this myself. You know, like, rather than emailing the mailing list and saying, can we move the dependency information either back into README or move the README into the info file, you know, something like that. Rather than doing that, there had to be a way that I, as a Linux user, could get what I wanted without the intervention of the administrative group, or even without a group consensus. And that's a big deal, because that is not something that you get all the time. You try going and modifying the installer program of your proprietary OS. I mean, is that going to happen? No, that's not going to happen. And frankly, at least at my level, go try to modify your package manager. Is that going to happen? Probably not. So, I don't know. The ability to do that, to take matters into your own hand and redesign your system so that it conforms exactly to your liking, to the way that you want to work, that's such an underestimated and underappreciated at times, I think, power that we as Linux users have. Maybe not underappreciated. I think actually we're all pretty aware of that. But I guess to people coming to Linux, I don't think they understand that potential or the impact that it has when you actually make it happen. So that's really cool. And it's something that I think we should all kind of keep in our heads for ammo when people ask that question, you know, like, why are you into this thing? Why do you care? It's because of this thing right here, like the fact that I was able, in the time that it took me to type an email saying, I don't like this, can it be changed? That's the same amount of time that it took me later in the same day to write this script that did change it and gives me a whole bunch of new features that turned out to be more efficient for me in the long run anyway. It's really cool stuff. You know what else is cool? Is this multimedia video that someone sent my way. It was Matt, listener of the show, I'm sure. Otherwise, he wouldn't have sent it. The link itself, or the video, is on ziph.org. So that's xiph.org. You might know that site as the home of Og, Vorbis, and Theora. So you've got ziph.org/video/vid1.shtml. And it's a brilliant video for so many reasons. It's about 30 minutes. It's got Chris Monty, or what's his name? Chris Montgomery, I think, is his real name. I think he's called Monty. Whatever. The guy who works on Theora and Vorbis. And he explains, he breaks down the very concept of, well, analog and digital sound and video and why it's encoded the way it needs to be encoded, how it's processed and understood by computers. He goes into the detail that you just can't even believe. It's an amazing video. And not only is it amazing for the technology that he's discussing, and he discusses it at a semi-beginner level. I mean, it's not super basic. It seems to be geared largely toward someone who's going to be programming with this information in mind. But I found it really, really enlightening, and I want to say that most people would, even if there's some stuff that goes way over your head. For instance, the fact that one file format is big Indian and one is little Indian, I have no idea what that means. I've never understood what that meant. I don't think I care, but I might. I'm not really sure. point is, that stuff was way over my head, but talking about like sample rates and the way that it all is figured and the different frequencies that the different sample rates are able to attain and what we really mean when we say lossy, all that kind of stuff, it was amazing. Now, the video is also amazing because of its style. Instead of using these fancy motion graphic things that everyone can generate now with any program, they did everything on a whiteboard. So they were, you know, it's almost a poor man's animation, you know, and subtitles and stuff. They did it in front of a whiteboard with these little illustrations and graphs and stuff. It just looked fantastic. I was so impressed. It had style to it, and I keep wondering if that was just because they didn't want to break out Blender for motion graphics, or if that was just a stylistic choice that they made. I couldn't really tell, but the artistry was just oozing from this video. I was so thoroughly impressed. It was so well put together, too. It was 30 minutes. We should have had to pay for this thing. It was worth a college course. I mean, it was just so good. And apparently there will be more in this series, which I really look forward to. The whole video was produced, as it says very clearly in the end, on nothing but free software, including Cinelera, for crying out loud. I don't know who is using Cinelera, but someone is, and they cut that video in it, and it works great. And the beginning of the video is just phenomenal as well, really just as an intro to like free software and the concept of free software and the concept of sort of why it's important that we should be able to do this and the scam that is the impression that we get. How is that for a sentence? That all this digital media stuff, like the encoding and decoding of media, is something that's elite. You know, you can't do it if you're not a member of this society or of this group, of this expert group, whatever. You know, it's just not legitimate. I mean, I can tell you right now that that's nonsense, because I'm a huge proponent and remain a huge proponent of Theora and Xvid and even WebM, although I haven't actually had as much experience with WebM yet. But I mean, these are great codecs, and they don't come from these big organizations, and I don't care what people say about X264 being able to do this and that. It doesn't bear truth in the end. Like, when you look at one video and another video and try to discern them, even in the file sizes and then the quality, the codec is not the driving factor in what you say, oh yes, that looks like a good video. The source material does, and the way that it was encoded does, and sometimes the way that it is encoded is kind of limited by the program that you're using to encode it, meaning that if you're using, for instance, Handbrake, which, you know, I mean, hey, I love that program for as easy as it is to use, but I mean, when you look at Handbrake's options that they give you for X264 versus Theora, it's just embarrassing. You know, it's just like, for Theora, you get to control the frame rate and the bit rate. And for X264, you have all of these other options that you can control. I mean, like, there's a whole tab full of options. Trellis on or off, GOP size, you can just go crazy with that. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, obviously the X264 stuff is going to tend to look better than the Theora if you're doing it that way, because you only have so many options. Whereas if you do it manually with FFmpeg or something, well, you have the whole spectrum available to you. So I think it's very important for people to understand that it's vital that we can do this ourselves, that we understand how to do this, and that we do it, that we actually implement these ideas ourselves in our own software, that we support them, that we use them. And one of the backgrounds in this video was this huge, it said consume on the whiteboard, you know, just big letters, consume, and then it was like, be passive, be happy, oh look, kitties. It was really, really funny. You need to see it. But I was looking at it and staring at it, and just like my entire life was flashing before my eyes, because it was exactly what, you know, what I've always had a problem with, like this idea that we are supposed to just kind of sit still and consume the stuff that this nebulous elite crowd is feeding us. So, and this video just expressed it so subtly, much more subtly than what I'm saying right now. You know, I'm describing it to you. If you look at it, it's so, I don't know, pure, both artistically and ideologically. It was just really beautiful. So I'm saying, go see this film, go see this video. It's 30 minutes. It was 30 minutes of, I couldn't bring myself to press pause, you know? I mean, like, I had stuff to do. I didn't really intend to sit down and watch the video when I sat down and watched it. I just thought, well, I'll take a quick look at it. I'll just see what it's all about. And I just could not take my eyes off of it. I couldn't get up. I was stuck to my seat. I was floored. It was really, really good. I highly recommend it. Another thing that I highly recommend is something that Deep Geek, if I recall correctly, or maybe it was Lost in Bronx, one of those two guys brought it to my attention. And we did Deep Geek, me, and Lost in Bronx, and I think maybe Sig Flup and maybe Skirlet did an Hacker Public Radio episode on this. It was our movie review series that we were doing for a little while. And it was the Infest Wisely movie. So Infest Wisely was like this ultra lo-fi kind of sci-fi story, and I really enjoyed it to such an extent that in the classes, the beginning film classes that I teach, I show clips or I make them watch the whole movie. It depends on what semester it is and how I feel. But I use Infest Wisely as a teaching tool because it's just so well done in terms of an engrossing story on a very low budget. So I count myself as a real fan of this movie. Now, completely separately, in a different spectrum entirely, I was talking to a friend who had read a graphic novel recently called Therefore Repent. And it was this post-apocalyptic kind of graphic novel about about some crazy stuff. It's really great. Go get it. Therefore Repent. It's sort of about like a post-apocalypse in the truest of word of the sense of the word apocalypse from the Greek apocalypsis, meaning the opening, the revealing. So in the Christian sense, the revealing of all the mysteries of heaven, essentially. So this is about the post-apocalypsis and what happens, but it, of course, isn't. I can't really say anything, so just go read it. I don't want to do any spoiling of the plot. But it's a great book. It's a graphic novel. It's well worth reading. And it's by this guy named Jim Monroe, who I'd never really heard of. Turns out Jim Monroe is sort of the mastermind behind I guess you could call it a collective or a website or something called nomediakings.org. That is nomediakings.org. And they're sort of an art group, I guess, that does a lot of self-publishing and some movies and things like that. They're an anarchist group and an artist group. And they produced both Therefore Repent, the graphic novel, and Infest Wisely. I was amazed when I read it. I was like, wait a minute, there's a connection here? And yeah, there is a connection there. It's No Media Kings and the writer, Jim Monroe. So I email the guy, and I'm like, hey, really like your stuff. You know, thanks for making it. And, you know, I'm into the same things that you're into. And I must have mentioned Linux, go figure. Turns out he's a Linux user as well, which was really cool to find out, especially coming from an anarchist. You know, you kind of want there to be some purity there. So yeah, it was really, really a neat little bit of contact. And so if you're into any of those things that I've listed so far, sci-fi, graphic novels, lo-fi movies, Linux, or anarchy, then check out nomediakings.org. I'm serious. There's really good stuff on there. You can, I mean, it's really cool too, because you can actually even download a lot of this stuff for free anyway. But as I've said, I think in the last episode when I was talking about games and stuff like that, if you can afford to pay, I think it's a nice thing to do. But if not, then go download it and experience it for yourself, because it is really good stuff. And if you haven't heard the Deep Geek, Lost in Bronx, and me, and Sig Flup maybe, and Skirlet maybe, episode about Infest Wisely, then go listen to that, because it's an analysis of the movie, but it's a really great movie. And I think if you're listening to this show, there's a high probability or possibility that you would like that film. There you go. That was No Media Kings and Ziff.org, all of those different places that are doing some kind of hybrid of technology and art and anarchy and online things. It's really nice. So good, check that out. And I think it's probably time to cue the ending music. Oh, darn it, that was the wrong ending music. There it is. So this has been GNU World Order. I'm Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or slackermedia.info/sport. Hint, hint. You can also email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me on Jabber, notklaatu@jabber.org. And you can find me on IRC as notklaatu. I'm in the channels of DevRandom, Ogcast Planet, Slackware, other places like that. Until next time.
Yeah?
Do you have a card reader?
Yeah.
Can I borrow it?